Well, I'm back, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome. If you saw me earlier on Deepest Lore, it's a fun episode about, well, not that fun, depressing episode, really, about propaganda in Ukraine. But I have momentous news, well, it's certainly momentous personally for me, is that I have finally finished Foundations of Politics. And I'm joined by a couple of my buddies here, Prudentialist. How are you doing, Prudentialist?
Very good. How are you? Congratulations on getting the course done.
Thank you. And Charlemagne, how are you doing?
Good. Unexpected stream. So, yeah, just chilling.
I mean, kind of rare to do like little party streams, right? I don't know what it is about this particular course, but of all the projects I've ever done, this one was it felt almost like a Sisyphean task at times. It was just like, no matter how much I chipped away at it, the end line kept on receding away from me. It was kind of weird because I've got the lodge. I was able to clear time, but, it was just kind of, I mean, you're a programmer, Charlemagne, or you've done you're kind of in that line of work. So I don't know if you ever worked on anything where it hits like 4 a.m., 4:30 a.m., and you find yourself like making a coffee, you know, to make it into like 8 a.m. and you're still working and you're like, what is going on? Because I've had just this week alone, I've had about like 5 nights like that just trying to get this course finished. But I was determined to get it out before March, and here we are. So I didn't even have a project like that.
Only in university. So yeah, congratulations on making your launch date. Always want to meet those deadlines. Very good.
Yeah, and now it's St. David's Day in here. It's just turned, I think, the 1st of March is St. David's Day. So I tell you what we'll do is... I might just talk you through what's on the course. How about that? And tell you what I've done here. I've got, if you're a member of the channel, by the way, or if you're a member of my Substack, you should have had like little coupons. Like, people are always asking me for coupon codes. I thought I'd give a little, given that it's launch day and I'm in a good mood, relatively speaking, I thought I'd give some coupons out for channel members for their years of loyal support. So, let me just share some images here from the actual course. Hold on. So this is the introduction. Where are we? Introduction. Okay. And I'll show you what's on there. I was too tired to make an actual like trailer. Maybe I'll do that at some point as well. 10 lectures, intro and conclusion, obviously the first and the last one. And then we're basically kind of, it's like a roller coaster through the core elite theory. So the rulers and the ruled is Moscow. But we also cover on there political formulas. We cover judicial defense. What else do we have a look at on there? All his standard arguments against democracy, the two stratas of the elites. So all of that is in the first lecture there. Then the second lecture is about the circulation of the elites. That's the Pareto. Charlemagne knows that material pretty well. The foxes and the lions, the class one and class two, you know, residues, derivations, and what's the other one? Residues, derivations, and sentiments. I will say, if I have one criticism of Pareto, I don't know why he needs that terminology. You could just easily call it like instincts and ideas and like it. So, but anyway, that's Pareto. And then that lecture actually goes pretty deep. We look into, because The Mind of Society is a massive book. It's like 2 million words. And I've got a compendium, which is like a kind of filleted version of Mind and Society, and even that is 500 pages long. In fact, I would blame Pareto for one of the core stumbling blocks early on in this, because I was like, I was up and running. I wrote the Moscow one, got my intro done. I was like, right, sailing. This is going to be out by November. And then it was just like, doof, you know, Pareto. And then on top of it, Pareto is super duper black pilling as well. I mean, if you want to, if people have noticed like a nihilistic turn in me in the past few months, is like 99% down to Pareto, I would say, who basically has this idea that, like, I don't know if I agree with him, to be honest, but he basically reckons like ideas and arguments just don't matter. To come back to our debate with Carl the other day, Charlemagne, he's like, yeah, never in the history of the world as a debate or an argument actually change anybody's mind. It's all down to these like non-logical sentiments. And when the mood changes, that's when you'll see the circulation and not before. No arguments will change it in the meantime. So he's kind of weird like that. There's no like, he gives no purchase to ideology in a way. So that's Pareto. Very interesting. And I've noticed something actually, which is that if there's a... can I put this? Sometimes when you'll see different people on the dissident right disagree about this particular topic, and it comes down to a core disagreement between Mosca and Pareto over whether ideas matter or not. Mosca says, well, you know, sometimes a new religion can come along, sometimes people can get an idea in their head, and it could lead to circulation of elites, the old, you know, the old ruling class being overthrown by an emergent ruling class. Pareto's like, nah, fuck all that. The ideas just don't matter. They're always post hoc rationalization. You know, it just comes down to is the society ready to have a predomination of lions to take over from effete foxes, or on the converse, sometimes lions are kind of when they're actually in power, they can be quite dull and kind of like non-innovative and mismanage things. So foxes like get back in, like round the back door, and then the whole process starts again. But he gives like, it's never about like ideas or like, you know, socialism or any of these things. They're all just like bollocks, according to Pareto. So, and I feel like in some of our debates with Keith and Joel and other people, under the hood, people are either agreeing with Pareto more or with Mosca more. And in fact, in that slightly more deterministic model that Pareto has, you can kind of see how he ended up as a fascist versus Mosca, who stayed as a liberal. I actually think it comes down to that. The same split can be seen between Sam Francis and Gottfried. Francis was more like Pareto-like, and he also was a bit more edgy than Gottfried. And I think it comes down to that, because it's like a super cynical position that gives no purchase to like bullshit at all. It always is looking for something underneath. So anyway, the fourth lecture is on Michel's Iron Law of Oligarchy and Organizational Structure. Michel's super important, super interesting thinker. And he basically takes the raw materials from Mosca and Pareto and applies it to everything, like everything. You know, where he says, who says organization says oligarchy? This is like watchword. And I really like Pareto's heavy going. Mosca can be pretty heavy going as well. Nice historian, kind of neat writing sometimes, but I feel like Michel's is like a humanizing element as well. He writes with a kind of passion. He hates bureaucrats and civil servants, and you can just tell he's like a real man under there. And it's all like, you know, real people in actual parties and trade unions and actual disputes. And so it kind of brings you back down to earth in a way. So I like Michel's for that. He feels less abstract than the other elite theorists and more human. He was also friends with both Mosca and Prato, and Mosca and Prato hated each other, but Michel's was a kind of protege or disciple of both of them. And I find that that's a kind of interesting thing too. So he's like a unifying figure within that camp as well. Probably, I mean, of all of the lectures, the one that has the most kind of, I mean, they're all pretty meaty, to be honest, but the one on Schmitt there, Sovereignty, Friends, and Enemies, the importance of the ideas in that. I mean, I have to say, people talk about, like, who's the most important thinker of all. After writing this course, I've come to the conclusion that it's probably Schmitt. He is so clear in the way that he, in the way that he expresses his ideas. He has such penetrating and insurmountable insights into power, politics, the political theology, nature of the political, friend-enemy distinction, the exception. I mean, it's all like brilliant stuff, but he has this way of writing it all in a super condensed way. So like, you know, I said Pareto's got like a 2 million word book. Schmitt's books are all like, you know, like 50 pages. And like each page is just brimming with stuff. So there's something like I would say Schmitt was a genius. I mean, I don't know about you guys. You can come in whenever you want, but I'm currently thinking, you know, at this moment that, you know, if anybody reads anybody, it should be Schmitt. The high-low middle mechanism is all about Juvenal. Juvenal is like, really, he's after reading the other guys, he's really French. Like, he's kind of grandiose in the way he writes, and he has this kind of bombastic style. But he has a really penetrating view of power. And you know, I talked about Black Pill. I think Juvenal, his view of power is this totalizing force that just is like sick and constantly seeks to eliminate its rivals, and has just got this will to expand and to, you know, brook no dissent, basically. Is once you understand what he's saying, so, well, how do we get out of this process? Because, I mean, without, you know, giving away too much of the core content of this course, he basically talks about how, like, every revolution that happens ostensibly happens as a liberty against an older oppression, but the new regime ends up being more oppressive, more centralizing, more total than the last regime. I mean, you can use the French Revolution as an obvious example, but Russian Revolution, you know, even if you could argue the Glorious Revolution in this country or the American federal state was more centralized than when the British Crown had it. So there's a lot of really interesting stuff in Juvenal. The other interesting thing in Juvenal is because he looks across all history and he basically says the model is always the same. So all of these ideas we have about like liberalism, communism, ideologies, you know, is it socialist? Is it fascist? Is it syndicalist? It all just goes out the window because it's like, fuck all that. It all works the same. It's always this high, low, middle, and this will towards centralization all the time. Doesn't matter what you call it. And I would say that is something that unites all of these thinkers, where they're spectacularly unconcerned with the kind of individual ideas that people have got, the actual ideologies people have. They're looking at this structurally and formally and saying, actually, there isn't really that much difference between these systems. You can dress it up whichever way you want. You can put pretty names on it. You can call yourself the land of the free. You can give yourself a constitution. But at the end of the day, none of this shit matters because power is power, and there's no alternative to it. And this is one of those, if you truly understand and come to terms with and accept what these guys are saying, it's much more difficult to have this notion that, you know, you're going to overturn the system, and in the new world, it's all going to be hunky-dory and a bed of roses, and we're fundamentally going to, it's not going to ever be corrupt anymore. These guys just basically give no scope to that, because the logic of politics and power are constant, and it doesn't matter like what your ideas are. I guess it will still function ultimately in the same way. In other words, if we ever do clear them out, many of the same problems will remain, although maybe with a few less trannies. Eh? Then the seventh lecture, the managerial elites, is about James Burnham. And really, the genius of Burnham, what he really does, if you kind of read between the lines, is he takes the insights of the elite theorists, but especially the insights of Michels, and he applies them to the market, and applies them specifically to the relationship between the shareholder, the stockholder, and the management of the company. So if you can imagine, we're all shareholders in a company. Those shareholders are like a kind of democratic vote within the company, in theory. But in practice, the managers of the company have de facto control, and there's nothing that the stockholders can do to organize, because as the mass underneath, they are, so the stockholders or the stakeholders become the passive ruled mass under the minority elite control of the managers. And that's really the logic of the managerial revolution. So when I saw Adam Friended earlier on making tweets about how elite theory is communism for dummies or whatever, actually Burnham is making a really profound break with the logic of Marxism and Marxist economic means of production type analysis, because it doesn't actually matter who owns the company. You can even have a CEO who's like a kind of 80% stakeholder in a company, and he can still be ousted by the management. And he's still basically doing, if he's in the managerial regime, he's still performing a managerial function, and he can be replaced with someone who isn't. You know, I look at I look at the Ford Motor Company quite a bit in that lecture, and there's this dude called William Ford Jr. or something. He's like the great great grandson or the great grandson of Henry. And like he's held like every position, like he's been the CEO, the COO, the chairman, but every single time he's replaced by like some dude from Boeing or some executive from elsewhere. So it doesn't actually matter that his name is Ford or not. You know, he's just a manager. He got an MBA from MIT or something, you know. Then Elites and Ideology is looking at the San Francis stuff. And in particular, that lecture looks, as well as San Francis, I look at Binet's, I look at Lippmann, I look at public relations as a function, as something that the likes of Burnham and the original elite theorists, they kind of take all that stuff for granted a little bit. Whereas Francis, he really understands the importance and power of mass communication. And then the therapeutic state is all about Paul Gottfried and how he looks at behaviorism, and he looks at how the managerial state kind of pathologizes everything. In fact, on Unpopular Opinions recently, John Dee had a fantastic rant about how everything is pathologized now, and everything is psychologized and given a label, and you know, suddenly things that were normal behaviors are now like given this, you know, they're made a disorder in some way. That is the heart of Gottfried's analysis. And what's scary about that book is he wrote that in 2002, 2003, years before like the COVID regime or some of the stuff we've like unconscious bias training and all these sorts of things. He saw the way things were going 20 years ago, but they've actually got a hell of a lot worse since he was writing. So, and then all throughout these lectures, really, I actually come back again and again to consider, I try to like apply what is the contemporary relevance of these ideas as well, and how does it apply to the regime in the here and now, to try to, and I try to use like up-to-date examples and, you know, generally just make it easier to understand all the way through. So that is the tall and short of the course. Any questions from you guys before I carry on?
How much is it?
So the course is, let me just share the front page, because I've done something a bit funky. I was feeling so happy to finish this course, I've set up a number of different things. So as well as those coupons I've given out, I've also set up some like mega bundle. So it's £350, just like Foundations of Politics is. Sorry, Foundations of Economics was, is still £350. But if you can get it together with Foundations of Economics and Research for £550, so you can get all three of them together, and that's a pretty significant discount if you get the bundle. Or you can get all the courses I've done, like the whole Trivium. I've called it the Mega Bundle. Politics, Economics, Trivium, and Research, all the courses for £750. And if you pick up a coupon, that discount will apply to the whole bundle. So you'd be getting like a huge amount of money off if you did that one. So that's it. Links are in the chat. Links are in the show notes.
How much money's worth of books do you think is condensed into that politics course?
I mean, I probably, how many books did I buy personally to make the course? I've got well over 40 books here that I used to, I've just got my show, I can see them now. And some of them were pretty hard to find. I probably spent, I don't know, I lose track really, but I easily spent over £1,000 just in books to condense it all down. I mean, one of the things I wanted to do is go beyond the just reading them and hit the secondary literature as well. As you'll hear in the introduction, I haven't like gone to town on what people's criticisms are, because so many of those criticisms are from the point of view of like someone trying to defend democracy or socialism or whatever. And it's like, they do these really dishonest moves where they're like, you know, they're trying to save these thinkers, quote unquote, by making them Democrats. Like, oh, actually, if you really understand what Robert Michels is saying, like he's really a Democrat under it all. Or like, if you really understand Carl Schmitt, he wasn't really a Nazi. He was, he was really up for like liberal democracy and he was trying to save it, all this sort of stuff. And I just didn't want to go into all of that because it's all ideological. And I know people bristle a bit at the claim to be value free, but I really was trying to strip things down to their essential elements and make it like a non-ideological in a way. I will say though that all of these writers and me, of course, are all human, and human beings just have preferences which are impossible to eliminate. So even Pareto, who is probably the most thoroughgoing in his value freeness, if you want, is still accused of being like ideological, because he basically says, you can tell he favors a man of action. You can tell he favors a lion leader, right? He, like, if Prato was around now, he'd be on the side of Putin against the foxes. It's just like his disposition. And a lot of, like, the secondary literature says, well, yeah, Pareto, but, like, why? That's a bit arbitrary, isn't it? Like, why is that your preference? Pareto's defense is like, well, in all times and places, violence is the norm, and you're trying to treat peace as the norm, and that's just a cope, basically. But you can kind of argue that both ways, if that makes any sense. Like, I mean, I agree with Pareto that violence is a kind of constant in human history, and you can't ever eliminate force as a consideration in politics, as all of our leaders are finding out right now, coming up against Putin. But I mean, it swings around. Like, you could say that's arbitrary to say, well, why are you making violence the norm and peace the exception? Why isn't peace the norm and violence the exception? And it's just like, I have no answer to that. It's just a matter of emphasis, I guess. So you get into these, like, really weird territories where, even though you're describing something ostensibly neutral, you get into these, like, weird language games, and it's like, which way around you describe it becomes ideological. I mean, Prude, I don't know if you have any insight into that question, because it must come up in geopolitics quite a bit, that use of violence and force idea as a norm versus, I don't know, a rules-based order where peace is a norm. I don't know.
Well, it gets, it's kind of been watered down a lot, especially in sort of the post-nuclear age, where now everything has been basically just turned into post hoc rationalism. So a lot of things nowadays, at least in Western international relations discourse, is basically just broken down into, can we calculate risk and then do we take action? Which is why every article I've seen so far about, like, what's happening in Ukraine is calling this a gamble, rather than talking about what were the calculations behind it. I mean, the rules-based system is kind of new, or at least a norms. I mean, you go back to Westphalia, you go back to the Vienna system, and even now with sort of the whole, you know, UN, NATO, and now sort of the World Economic Forum. There was a point in time where violence would be the way after, you know, the first couple of rounds of talks failed, and now we're kind of seeing the evolution of that, but things are just a little more with higher stakes, considering what kind of weaponry is available.
Yeah. One of the things that I've realized, and it's taken me to write this course to truly realize what it is and why, how can I say, like, why so many of us start off as libertarians or liberals and then come to these positions later on. But also, like, why is it that we all struggle up against what I'm calling, like, the unreality of the world? And I think that ultimately liberalism is an attempt to escape the political. It's an attempt to try to create this, like, fluffy world where you can escape violence, you can escape war, everybody can get on. You know, all we need to do is trade together and we're going to hold hands and it's going to be nice and nobody's ever going to interfere with anyone else. And I mind my own business and you mind your own business. And but unfortunately, the world just isn't like that and human beings aren't like that. And that liberal, I would say, if I had to sum up one idea, the liberal attempt to escape politics is what this course mows down and makes basically just impossible to escape through these. I mean, any one of these thinkers alone, I would say, does that. But, like, all eight of them together, it's just like there's no way out, basically. That, I think, is a realization that the collective right has slowly been making together. I still reckon most people don't get it. More people get it than used to get it, but still most people don't, I would say. especially in the establishment right, in like in the GOP or Tory party in this country. I mean, they're just hopeless, you know, to the extent where they're not really on our side at all, we have to conclude. So, okay, what else shall I mention? Oh, Skeptical Waves has arrived. Hello, Skeptical Waves. You're right.
Hey, congratulations, hey.
Thank you very much. That was the most Canadian thing I've ever heard. Hey, hey.
I that's definitely an affect, a fake affectation. We don't we don't sound like that really.
Do you have any questions about the course?
Yes, I do. What do you want to narrate next for supporting material?
Well, I mean, and all of the books would be helpful to have on there. I think Moscow got a huge boost when you put the audio version on. Let's have a look. I mean, Paul Gottfried's still alive, so you might want to check with him. Paul Gottfried, by the way, has read the course.
Ooh.
And he said that he was blown away by it. So I'm really pleased with that. I couldn't get. He's the only living author on the course, and for him to like give it the blessing type thing was something I was really pleased with.
Any chance for an interview or an endorsement with him?
Or maybe I'll go back to him. Or maybe when the book comes out, maybe I'll go back to him. But
I think I saw that he was on Nolan's podcast. Nolan Knows.
Yeah, he did an interview recently, didn't he? Past day or so. I tell you what would be good to have, if it's not already available anywhere, is Juvenile. Is On Power like in audio form anywhere?
I already have it.
It's already like the whole
yep.
thing.
Yep, I've already done the whole thing.
What the fuck is this? Okay, sorry. Fucking mall bug is on Alex Jones.
What?
What the hell is this planet?
that's not a fake photo.
That's not a fucking thing.
No.
Well, he's gone on.
I mean, like Great Force Plus. Sure. Oh my god, this is absolute clown mode.
We need a link. Oh, there it is.
I swear it's real. I'm linking it in the chat right now.
No.
Let me have a look. Oh my god.
I was like, those are some really good Photoshops.
Is that today? This is recent.
No.
Tropic is back in stock at InfoWarsStore.com.
That is today.
Ultra for yourself.
Let's have a look.
Curtis Yarvin versus the Deep State. Oh. Can we avert?
Okay. All right. What's he doing?
Okay.
So, all right. Well, fair enough. He's on the course as well, by the way. He doesn't have a week to himself, but I do. There are like a few cameo appearances from Yarvin on the course. I can't remember which ones I mentioned now, but he the extent to which Yarvin has ripped Juvenile without like explicitly referencing him is something. I tell you, it really is.
So this is actually something I noticed. It's something that I experience in my writing in my normie job, is that I have absorbed a whole bunch of knowledge and material from all the reading that I've done, but I'm really terrible at knowing where it came from. And so he works like that, being kind of a more computer science STEMy guy.
Maybe. I mean, I'm not saying he's done it deliberately. I'm just saying, of course. Like, it's just, how can I put this? When you're blatantly relabeling things, there's something about the Juvenile one that is just a bit like, let me see if I can find that slide. I'll tell you what I'm talking about now. See if I can find it. Hold on.
Have we lost the other hosts who are busy watching Moldbug now?
I was watching it. That was hilarious. I did listen to the Schmidt stuff on the way to the conference, by the way. So I'm familiar with Schmidt now. I kind of agree with what you said earlier, by the way, about Schmidt being the one to read. He's much more
concise, and I think he addresses liberal democracy much more directly, whereas, you know, he's not going really for a value-free analysis in the same way that Pareto and Mosca do.
He's a lot more modern in some sense, right?
Yes, yes.
This is what I'm talking about, though, right? So we know C.A. Bond's nemesis is built on top of Juvenal, and he's really explicit about the fact it's Juvenalian, right? But Yavin has got old posts. I can't remember exactly. I think it's in the old, like, Mencius Moldbug stuff, where he's like talks about this exact mechanism, the high, middle, low. But he uses nobles, commoners, and clients, right? So it's the patron theory of politics. It's blatantly Juvenal's idea. But then he attributes it to, like, he says, oh, well, Orwell says, like, he mentions Orwell. And I just don't really get, like, I mean, unless I missed it, he doesn't mention Juvenal at all. So unless Yavin came up with that on his own independently, it's just a massive coincidence. So, you know, saying. All right.
I'm muting.
What's going on in the chat?
Let's have a look.
Oh, I got recommendations. Well, I've got a Google Docs forms link on all of my recent posts going back a couple of months for you to submit things to do. So please send them there. Otherwise, I will lose them.
I saw some guy sending you stuff for Putin stuff.
There's another. There's another speech he gave, but the only thing I found so far is excerpts that are translated. So I might have to find the original transcript and do my own translation.
One of the things that I'd love to see people read is Walter Lippmann's The Phantom Public.
The first suggestions, actually. After I did Lippmann's other one, what is it?
Public opinion.
Thank you.
I think the fact that Phantom Public book is really quite it's like a kind of elite analysis, but it's like unapologetically kind of he's on the side of like liberal elites as well. So he's like he's on Team Evil. So it's always fun reading Team Evil people. He was like Edward Bernays's mate, you know. But I mean, it's literally Lippmann saying, yeah, you need to give everything to people like Edward Bernays to manage, you know.
Yeah, well, I've got to do the other Bernays book as well.
With this talk of, the foundations of politics and skeptical waves here, maybe we could think about the trucker protest a little bit, apply some of this here. What happened there? Because it seems to have just ended. Conclusion?
I think that we... was it your mate Prude, or I think it was Prudentialist friend, the Canadian guy.
Oh, it's a Radlib's friend.
It was Radlib's friend. Yeah, Black Horse.
Black Horse.
Black Horse. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the intel we had from Black Horse was that there was elite backing for the truckers, but only insofar as their objective was to get rid of Erin O'Toole, and as soon as that was done, they kind of let the truckers have it. And that's pretty much how it played out. And then, miraculously, the Canadian government and then all the governments around the world dropped their COVID restrictions, including New Zealand in the past couple of days.
Yes and no. The restrictions aren't all lifted here yet. In New Zealand, what happened actually is they had a lawfare win with their Supreme Court saying this is unconstitutional. Our courts haven't even heard, as far as I'm aware, heard a challenge. They've completely mm-hmm. deferred at the lower courts. If without an emergency injunction, there's essentially you're backed up with all the courts being still slowed down by all of the restrictions. So there mm-hmm. hasn't been proper hearing on this. In terms of what happened, as Black Horse mentioned, as predicted, the kind of whatever interference was being run in the halls of power to protect the truckers disappeared. And yeah, they went full force against them. They didn't, as we're well aware, they did the Emergency Act. They froze all kinds of bank accounts. They moved in with the federal police and corralled everybody. They used force, they used violence directly, and they they cleared everybody out and they towed everything away. So what they needed to do, it seems at the end, what happened in terms of the Emergencies Act, what they needed the Emergencies Act for was they were unable to find industrial towing equipment where people would voluntarily do it. And the Emergencies Act enabled them to essentially press gang these companies into actually doing the towing work. And they all came in, you know, faces fully covered with balaclavas to do the work, all their signage covered and everything in their trucks to actually do the towing work.
Oh, wow. That's incredible.
And most ridiculous part, of course, and who knows how this is going to work out in the end, is that on the Friday night, they managed to get the Commons to pass the bill. And then on, what is it, the Saturday or the Sunday, they pulled the bill before the Senate got to vote on it. So as far as, you know, lawfare is concerned, I'm pretty sure everything they did was illegal, according to the Emergencies Act and the rules. But it's already done. So what is there to do now?
Well, of course, the rules, I mean...
That's
the number one implication of Schmitt, right?
That Schmitt stuff was perfect. When I read Political Theology, as I was getting it prepped for narration, this explained everything about exactly this exception and the state of emergency and everything. It's just do whatever you're going to do.
Yeah, one of the interesting things about reading Schmitt is, you know, the idea of the exception is very specific. We use these terms pretty loosely, I think, but exceptions are, his definition of the exception is when an event occurs that's not defined in law. And it doesn't mean just using arbitrary powers, right? It specifically refers to making a decision that isn't already decided by whatever legal code your regime has, which is a little bit different than the way it gets thrown around. Like Schmitt's exception kind of gets thrown around as the idea of, you know, the ruling class just sort of ignoring the rules completely, which isn't actually what Schmitt means by that.
Yeah, he means more the decision that happens when you arrive at something outside of the rules. And, you know, in this case, that seems like what we actually ended up with, since the Emergencies Act didn't really apply in the end. At least, you know, in terms of it being actually ratified by somebody.
Yes, it's any time you're off the reservation. But if you truly understand what Schmitt's saying, he's basically saying, like, most of the time you're never on the reservation, that the idea of the legal norm is always fictional, that liberals live in this fictional world of where the law applies, but in fact the reality takes place in the exception almost always, basically. So, you know, and the true root of power is what he calls decisionism, you know. D, welcome.
Hello, AA. How are you doing?
You're sounding very sniffly.
Yes. I have another cold, which is very strange, of course, because I never used to get these common garden illnesses, and now after COOF, I get them all the time. So, but I'm soldiering on.
You're like AAA. Worse than AAA.
Exactly, you know. Horrible.
But anyway.
This doesn't sound like much like a party, by the way. Very very grim conversation.
Well, Foundations of Politics is not a lot of fun, I'll be honest. It's not like everybody watching this should buy a copy of Foundations of Politics. And in fact, I was thinking of tying down like Sargon and forcing him to watch it like Clockwork Orange style, you know, until each of the lessons are taken. Every pill must be swallowed.
I think Schmitt, I don't know if he says it explicitly, but he has a very interesting way of conceptualizing what liberalism is, which relates to that talk with Sargon. And he basically views the end of liberalism as the elimination of the friend-enemy distinction. Basically, again, friends and enemies are very specific. It really comes down to whether or not two groups are willing to wage war against one another. And the goal of liberalism is to prevent all wars by eliminating the friend-enemy distinction, which can only occur in bodies politic. Yeah.
Sorry, I have to laugh. Obviously, people are buying the course and the orders are coming in. I have to laugh at this though. Saddam Hussein just purchased Foundations of Politics. It's just funny. It's just funny. This person's called himself Saddam Hussein. But thank you.
He sticks to the character also. AA. So if you ever see him in the Telegram chat, he will literally just LARP as Saddam Hussein. It's great.
Right. Well. Okay. Sorry if I just outed you, whoever you are, Saddam Hussein. But,
amazing. Yeah. You know. Since you mentioned Clockwork Orange, I'm just having this vision of Carl, you know, being brought up on a stage to prove that he's been reformed, and you know, you like haul out John Locke, and you know, Carl like falls down and goes into paroxysms and vomits. You know.
Yeah.
A naked John Locke stands before him, and he can't.
Indeed, yeah. Or he starts vomiting whenever he gets a liberal thought, you know, maybe. Whenever he starts talking about equality under the rule of law or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, more practically, for at least for the short term, it means I can do fun things again. It means that I'm not like literally, you know, Jack Torrance from The Shining, stuck in the lodge, just working all day, every day, all night, every night.
So how long was it from conceptualization to release here?
I mean, Foundations of Politics was the first course on the site. So it's as long as, I think I launched Academic Agency in September 2020. So technically speaking, it's been like almost 2 years in the making. But realistically, first of all, I had to get all the materials and the books and track down obscure sociological studies on the elite theorists and ex-library books written in the 70s by like dusty Marxists, etc. But I would say that I've been working on it pretty solidly since October. So what's that? October, November, December, January, February. It's like 5 months of just working on this nonstop. So,
Did my joke come through? Did Mrs. AA sneak in and page through the manuscript with horror in her face?
Yeah, I mean, if you buy this,
how do you like it?
All work and no play makes Jack a dull boy over and over again.
You know? Yeah, people will buy it, and then it'll just be you for 10 hours just saying that over and over again.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I have yet to deal with is when people, there's a bundle at the moment where you can get, in fact, there's two bundles where you can get Foundations of Politics and Foundations of Economics together. I recommend you do Foundations of Economics first, and then Foundations of Politics will just like erase everything you've just learned. Because, I mean, the notion of like a functional free market is rendered basically impossible by the thinkers in this course. And that is something that I think we, that is a topic that we have, I think, put out of mind a little bit. I don't know if it came up at the event. Did anybody talk about economics at the event, Charlie or Prude?
There was one speech on econ.
And what was his general line? Was he like, was he trying to push a free market line, or what was he?
Well, it was more like a measurement in economic terms of the decline. Charlemagne could probably give you a better take. I had to step out. I had a phone call.
Yeah, I forget the name of the metric he used, but sort of the main thing he looked at is it was Oro's post, by the way. I don't know if you've seen his channel before. But he used this metric basically like the amount of new dollars created from debt. I don't think I'm framing it exactly right though. I think it was like a four letter acronym. Like basically taking out more debt gets you less actual value. And the ratio is currently at historic low. So I think
chat says marginal product of debt.
Marginal, yeah, that's what it was called. Marginal. So we look up marginal product debt.
Yeah, he was talking about the marginal product of debt, the amount of money that can be printed by the Fed, and the problem with the euro dollar, and as well as the law of diminishing returns. And it was the only econ speech at the event. He went into it in far more detail to me the weekend prior to the event, like at a Denny's for like 2 hours. It was quite the experience.
I mean, I know Imperium Press have just republished List's kind of famous political economy book on like nationalist economics. I've picked that up. I might read it. So one of the things I'm going to do now that I've got a bit more free time is I want to schedule like a bit. I've got so many, you know, that meme of all the people with all the books, the unread books that you've got, the orbs of the unread books.
Yeah.
I want to set aside like maybe an hour a day where that's what I do in that hour. Just like schedule it, you know, between, I don't know, 2 p.m. and 3 p.m. I read or something, just to get into the habit of doing that, because this has eaten up all my time. And but one of the things I want to do is start thinking about econ again a little bit, because I think one of the things that it's easy to forget about is that there is a kind of freedom afforded by the small business owner, the independent entrepreneur, as distinct from like the Peter Thiel or the Elon Musk, who, as Dee has described many times, are just kind of always already knee deep in the system, right? There's no way of making it in this system without being like kind of part of the managerial regime, if you want to put it that way. But this kind of lower level of entrepreneurship, where it's just like truly, you know, somebody spots a gap in the market and they get up and running, and they, you know, they don't need those like government grants or anything like that.
Like the academic agency.
Like the academic agency, for example, or anybody who really has a kind of smaller enterprise, if you want. I do think there is scope for a kind of radical freedom in there. And I don't think that we should complete, like, everybody's like, oh, libertarianism, you know, gay and cringe and all that sort of stuff. But I do think there's something in that. And I think that if you look at many of us, we are kind of men of independent means these days.
Speaking of means, your chat is complaining your entropy is offline.
Oh, is it? Sorry. Dee, you work for yourself, right? You kind of make things for people, and I think there's something in that where nobody's truly independent from the system, but you're more independent from the system than, I don't know, like a HR manager or...
Yes. In fact, I employ people to work for me on occasion. So, but you're right. And certainly it depends upon what you're doing as well. I mean, you know, I have to be in a field where I have an extraordinary amount of freedom. So yes, there's something to be said for that.
So, yeah, I think there's some, I mean, I just think that we shouldn't throw out all elements of something just because it feels like unfashionable. And there is something in that. And it runs all the way through, like even in Francis and Juvenal and all these people, there is scope for that streak of independence from that class of people, from that kulak class. So both like practically, that is a lot of the people in our kind of circles do have that background, but also like it is a potential node of resistance, just by its very nature. How you organize those people is another question, of course, because by their very nature, the more independently minded somebody is, the less clubbable they are, right? And I think that's something else that me and Dee have in common, being not very clubbable types.
Yeah, does not work well with others, you know. But I do think people in our circle are, I mean, we I would hope, are mature and intelligent enough to resist this idea of purity, you know. I don't think any of us are ever going to subscribe to, like, the pure idea of a system. I think we always understand that there's always going to be a hybridization. You know, it's never going to be like one solution, one system. It's always going to be a kind of mixed bag of personal and and larger solutions to various problems, you know. And I think that especially younger people, young men, tend to be very minded towards a sort of purity. You know, they want everything to fit into one system, and so I think yeah. that's one danger of you know having a kind of movement composed you know where you've mm-hmm. just got too many people wanting to purge systems of their sloppiness. And I think the sloppiness is actually where a lot of the traction comes from.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is one of those, because one of the, I guess, the black pilling implications of all of this is that there's no outside of the totalizing nature of each of these systems. The best you can hope for is to eke out a little bit of freedom in the cracks, which sounds like a real like lowering of expectations, right? But if there's enough friction in the system, I mean, several like Mosca, Burnham, and Juvenal all come out with this kind of, it's not like a fudge, but it's just like a kind of hope they've got, where Burnham says if you can get the managers managing each other, if you can just get them, like, you know, so rather than the trade unions nuzzling up to the corporation who nuzzle up to the government and all three of them working in lockstep, in an ideal world, you want the corporations against the government, you want the trade unions against the corporation, you know, and in that tension between those three power centers, we, the individuals, can kind of like play in the freedom a little bit, because it kind of gives you space to breathe. And I think the problem that we've got at the moment is that there is no, like, all of the institutions, like every church, everything is just on one side in lockstep, and I think it's intolerable for us. I feel like that's why we feel that we don't have any freedom, because there's nowhere to escape from it. It's like, it really feels like now, you know, you look at the map and like, where could we run to? You know, we could even go to, I don't know, like Hungary or the Cayman Islands, and you still wouldn't escape this shit. That's what it feels like to me. Unless you're John Dee, of course, in his underground.
Yeah, I recommend Bond. The bottom of the ocean. That's where I recommend. The Marianas Trench is about as far as you can go to get away from the gay.
Yeah, but the trouble is that even that solution of managing the managers and the trying to keep them in equilibrium, fighting against each other, the logic of power is still that it wants to converge. So power wants them all to start like lining up. And it's just like, when they all line up like this, that's where you have to come up with, clear them out, basically. There has to be a circulation. Otherwise we're suffocated and snuffed out. Because I'm increasingly finding it like intolerable. I don't even see anyone. I'm just like sitting here in the, you know, on the top of a hill in my lodge, and I still find it like almost intolerable. So God knows what it's like for people who are still in the system and, you know, having to go to work and speak to normies and so on. I can't even.
Well, they've made it so, certainly COVID made it so that you can't escape. You can't go to the shop. You can't step out of your house without having to face political realities. I mean, I think that's part of what the masks were, you know, is that you can't look at any other human in the face without being reminded of the fact that you're controlled. And I think there's something very powerful in that. And I think that's why they are so reticent to let go of that power. It's this pernicious idea of the personal is political. There is no place for you to go. There is no escape from this totalizing system.
The office kind of life of going into work and listening to boring like business calls is just absolutely demoralizing. I don't know how most people who don't have like a network or some kind of, you know, release system do it. Like I listen, unfortunately, to like regional calls pretty much on a weekly basis. And it's the epitome of like bio-Leninism. It's just basically a very loud black woman telling me that you have to trust the science and that you have to get your, like your regions, you know, they have to listen and get their booster or whatever. And it's just like, if you are not already, you know, in the system that, and believe that crap. Like, I don't know what it's like for maybe a normie with like slightly right-wing opinions, which is why I'm like really thankful that at least for us, we have this network. And I think the event in the US was a good proof of concept that you're not alone. So, you know, this is cancer, and I, myself and anyone else just who isn't in office, like, be thankful for what you have, because I'm sure it's suffocating.
So let me hit these super chats and we'll get out of here, and I'll go and watch, see what Curtis has to say to Alex Jones, maybe. Rogue Crusader says, just a reminder, John Lennon is in hell, taking it in the ass from Yoko-faced demon hordes. So there we go. Jacob says, speaking of Clockwork Orange, why does it seem to me that the murder weapon from the film is something that Dee would own? It's a movie prop. He seems to have a lot of those. Two, it's modern art. Three, it's phallic. Four, it was used to cleanse the world of a woman. A cat lady, in fact.
Absolutely based.
You know what he's talking about, that kind of big white.
I know phallus. Exactly what he's talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, we might do Kubrick on Deepest Lore at some point coming up. When we get our act together. Billy Blunt.
Sorry.
Billy
fucking Sam Hyde's on Fox News. This day is ridiculous.
What do you mean Sam Hyde is actually
he's not a
guest?
No. Tucker Carlson mentioned him. Just mentioned his name while he said comedian Sam Hyde. He's looking at that Adam Kinster tweet claiming that Sam Hyde is the ghost of Kiev. This is ridiculous.
I know, the Yarvin and Alex Jones and Tucker and Sam Hyde, it's a convergence of fucking complete weirdness.
How come Curtis Yarvin, like, since this point, hold on a minute.
Sure.
I would say.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. And so
he looks like he's gone backwards in time. Like he looks like, I don't know, like younger, like 90s Curtis Yarvin, or like his hair is more curly, and at least from the footage I saw, he looks like he's become, I don't know, like more twizzle haired or something, I guess you'd call it.
He's unfurled his kundalini and released his chakras.
I don't know. I thought his hair looked straight when I interviewed him, and now his hair looks curly. So maybe he used an iron on it. I never told you about that, did I? I had a little period where I ironed my hair. Billy Bloggs. Billy Bloggs says, isn't the friend-enemy dichotomy what cults inculcate in their adherents? Can you explain how you are different? I am a suppressive person for even asking. Scientology reference. Well, the friend-enemy distinction. In the way that Schmidt uses it, he's not talking about a personal friend or enemy. He's saying that the essence of the political is the distinction made between a public friend and a public enemy. And this is like, how can I put it? So back when Gordon Brown, Nick Clegg, and David Cameron were debating in 2010, and famously we got from Gordon Brown, I agree with Nick. Do you remember that? Basically, they were just agreeing on... They agreed on all of the main questions of the day. What they disagreed on was like tax rate and like tuition fees and a couple of other small things. So those disagreements don't attain the status of political for Schmidt. However, let's pretend that Nick Clegg in that debate said, actually, I'm not sure about political correctness. I'm up for racism, right? That would have been like a tear in the matrix. And suddenly everybody in that room, Gordon Brown, David Cameron, the studio audience would have all turned on Nick Clegg if he has said, I am up for racism, because that is outside of the agreed consensus and has attained, he has now become a political enemy. Because, and that's really what Schmidt is talking about. It's those very fundamental issues. And what's happened in our discourse over the past 4 or 5 years, maybe even longer, I would say really since Obama first became the Democrat candidate, the discourse has become more and more political, and people have become more and more divided between friend and enemy, to the point where now every election in America is treated as an existential crisis for the loser. And I mean, really what should happen is the loser should just be like, okay, fine, we lost the election, but ultimately, you know, these new leaders, we agree with them on most things and we'll carry on. We'll put faith in the new government. That doesn't happen anymore. You know, like when Trump won, they accused him of cheating. When Biden won, they accused him of cheating. And in fact, in the 2020 case, Trump didn't even concede the election. So that is a system which is having a problem, because people like next door neighbors are seeing each other as friend and enemy, and the system continues to have that problem. So carry on, Dee.
Oh no, I was just going to say, I mean, I remember I was in America and in and around September 11th, 2001, and I that was certainly something that was starting to come in over there at that time. I remember the John Kerry, George Bush election, and there was hints of that kind of idea that everything, that this was an apocalyptic choice, and you either win or it's the end of the world, and that is, as it seems like, it's certainly gotten worse over there. I mean, the Obama was maybe a sort of an aberration, because you know, there was very little resistance to that, but
it's crept into our politics a little bit, because I would argue that Jeremy Corbyn was an existential threat to Tories, basically. And I mean, I felt it at the time as well. Looking back, I kind of wish he'd kind of
could be. Oh yeah, I'm totally team Corbyn now, but yeah.
So yeah, I mean, the friend enemy distinction is, that's what they're really talking about. It's not, he's not talking about making a cult, or if he is, the cult is a very large cult, like, I don't know, like the Democrats in America or something like that. Or even wider, like from the outside, everybody in a liberal democracy looks insane. You know, like when Putin called the gay the empire of lies, what he was referring to is that, like, anybody looking at the behavior that we've seen in the past week from the outside would think that everybody was in a kind of mass hysteria cult. Even though we're talking about millions of people here, and I feel like that.
Oh, I think they are. I don't think the number has anything to do with it. I think people are certainly completely insane.
Do you guys think that the West wanted Putin to do this war because they think we're going to benefit from it, basically? Like, how dumb were they? Do they think that, I mean, because like I said in the blog I wrote last night, which you should go check out on my Substack, Russia is going to pay a high price for the war no matter what, right? And they're basically betting that their long-term gains here are going to outweigh the short-term costs that they're going to face. Does NATO think that the costs are going to be so high that gamble doesn't pay off, or are they just totally retarded, basically? I don't know.
I was brushing up on Mearsheimer in his opinion on all this, and go look at my channel for narrations from some of his things. And his opinion is that the West is actually doesn't even understand Putin, like at a fundamental level. It's this 21st century mindset of, the U.S. is just a benign hegemon versus Putin's 19th century power politics and balance of power. I don't know, Prudentialist is the expert on this, but that's what my reading material
David
was.
David Starkey had a very similar take, which was very good as well. I'm inclined to agree. I feel like I'm calling it the unreality of our leaders, but it's not just our leaders. It's a sizable portion of the public as well. They have an inability to think outside of the kind of modern liberal frame. So that the basic assumption is that everybody should share your values. And if they don't, they're somehow evil, or they're somehow, you know, there's something wrong with them. So they're imposing a kind of moral normative on all of history, which is why they increasingly attack, history as well. They're like, kind of, they judge history by modern standards, and you know they want to tear down the past if it doesn't live up to, you know, those universal ideals. But at the same time, that means that they can't, like you were saying, Skeptical Waves, that means they literally cannot understand Putin. They also cannot understand the use of force as a political instrument, as a normal thing that every person does. In that Starkey talk, he mentioned there was a Q&A. I didn't actually see this. I only heard Starkey talking about it, where Putin was asked about his use of force. And he gave a very interesting answer, where he was basically saying, like, you can use force for good, especially if it's in self-defense, which is just such a different way of thinking about things from the insane kind of shrill cat lady version, where, you know, it's just this kind of world where we're just meant to infinitely take in refugees and have compassion. What's the word they love to use? You have to have compassion. You want to have to show you're caring. My hope is that this is a kind of reality wake up call. If not for the leaders themselves, then just for like the system, just for the global system. Anything else, or should I carry on? Interent says, if you have time, would you be interested in supervising a framing analysis of the media for eventual publication? I pretty much know what I'm doing. I just don't want to bomb peer review and have to redo it all. Payment can be made. I am just a lowly servant tier academic who doesn't know anyone. Send me an email and tell me more, I would say. Send me an email and tell me more about that. It really depends on the time constraints, because I find myself with less and less of it these days. Then over on the main super chats, what have we got? We've got Arrows post says, no stream sniping allowed. Come join Yiz's stream. Yes, sorry about this. It was kind of unscheduled. I just couldn't be bothered to make a video. I'll probably do it tomorrow, but I wanted to be able to like launch this and get it out in a manner that didn't miss the deadline. So that's Ewan Lloyd Roberts says, on Pog Day, Vladimir Putin sent a sussy tank column over to Dat Boy River. Charlemagne has a stream analyzing how the meme pipeline disruption may destroy Europe's big chungus. What are your thoughts?
What the fuck did you just... What?
That was amazing. That's awesome.
Zoomer denial of service.
That's really...
Dee, I hope that you clip that.
I will.
I have no idea what I just read.
Big chungus, big chungus.
AA, this is Mandaras. AA, I discovered you when I was 15 years old. I'm 21 now. All I can say is, thanks for all the red pills. You have been my intellectual godfather. Well, thank you very much, Mandaras. Is that slightly disturbing that he was 15 when he was first watching me and now he's 21? Feels like...
You're going to have so many of those.
No, you know, but I'm kind of envious of them, because I mean, think about how many people who start out in like college or whatever who are just like, oh, they started with Sargon, but no, we just skipped all of that garbage and we moved straight to the base stuff.
I'm slightly concerned about that, though. I mean, I would like to think that my red pills are for life. You know, once you truly come to some of these conclusions, I don't know how you go backwards. But one of the psychological things that happens is that if somebody encounters something when they're, let's say, a teenager, then they kind of grow up, as it were, and go into the world of work and they go to university and so on. They have this notion that because they encountered the idea when they were a teenager, it's therefore childish in some way, and now they've quote unquote grown out of it. And that's not that's just a kind of notion that it's because you encountered it when you were younger, therefore it's childish, which makes no logical sense, Foundations of Logic fans. I am just aware of that potential, because the only people I've seen go the wrong way, i.e. like retake the blue pill, have been those sorts of people who encounter these sorts of spheres when they're like in school or whatever, and then they like, oh, it's time to leave childish things behind, now I'm an SJW, you know. So that's the only thing I'm not saying this chap will do that. I'm just saying it's something that we have to look out for. And if anybody has any suggestions for how to prevent that from happening, let me know.
Well, this was actually a part of the speech I gave at the US event, was talking about just the digital space, deracination and escapism, is that you kind of have to understand that you're not going to save everybody, and that you also need to recognize that when lefties like complain on YouTube that like, oh, as a creator, you have a responsibility to your audience, yada, yada, yada. They're right, but not in the way that lefties like to complain when you talk about spicy things. It's that you have the obligation, I think, to not just tell them to do something stupid. Not too long ago, I had a conversation with like a patron. He like donates $1 a month, but he asked a question because he's a younger guy about university. And I just had to tell him, like, turn off your politics brain for 5 fucking seconds and recognize that, like, you need to get a good, like, get, you know, study something that's going to get you a job and think about how you can provide for yourself, your family, and, you know, what you want to accomplish. Because you can't be thinking, like, especially with the younger people, Zoomer politics brain discovers you at 15 or whatever, and this is the way I'm going to live. Because they haven't had real hard, you know, contact front with reality yet. And I think that that's where it bears in mind, and you especially, because you have a long career, you know, in academia. You especially could definitely be a guide for these people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have no answer to. I mean, it's one thing. I see. There's certain things that I would say it's acceptable to quote unquote grow out of, and that is in fact those ideologies that Dee was talking about, which tend towards like utter purity, you know, the anarcho-capitalist, for example. No offense to Radlib.
Objectivism,
or I don't know, like, you know, further on the right, I'm going to be a full all out, Viking rune wielding Nietzschean Superman, white nationalist, you know. Those sorts of positions I can see people quote growing out of. What I struggle to imagine is people growing out of some of the deeper implications of the things we've talked about, how the media works, going back to believing the lies of these snakes, basically. How do you do that? I mean, I just don't. If anybody does that, I would say that I would take that as a failure. If somehow somebody plugs back into the matrix and they're watching CNN or whatever, you know. Once you've seen the total outline of Boomer Truth, to go back and believe the lies of Boomer Truth, for example, these are kind of like deeper analyses, or any of the stuff I talk about on Foundations of Politics, which are basically just kind of like, how can I say, like showing how the magic trick is done. Well, now you know how it's done. So why would you ever, how could you ever go back to believing the illusion again? That's the deeper worry I have. I've yet to know anyone who actually has done that yet. I've seen people who were like, you know, into me when they were a libertarian, and then now they've moved on to something else. All that sort of stuff is fine. It's the other thing. This is why people like Lord Urquhart kind of disturb me so much. You know, I mean, maybe he was never red pilled. I don't know. D, you remember him from back in the Deep Lore, but
no,
these characters who somehow like are, you know, all rah rah supporting the gay on Russia now. It's like,
yeah, you know, or the infamous Callum, if you remember him.
Or Callum, yeah. Fearless Leader says, "Hey, Skeptical Waves, how about a Pareto the Miner Society audiobook?"
Yeah, I believe that one was interrupted by you requesting Mosca instead. So that's in progress.
It is 2 million words long, though.
Yeah, I was glad you interrupted. But Fearless Leader is a great patron for a huge number of us, and I appreciate his support.
Yes, Fearless Leader. Yeah, he's I see him on Twitter sometimes.
Extremely old school.
He's got a good econ head on him as well. He's a bit hardcore, though, his Fearless Leader.
I think Sociology for the South might be a good one for you to do. I just finished reading that. I still have to read through the appendices, but that text is surprisingly relevant for being written in 1850. It has very modern takes, I guess, in a good way.
Now, why is Mike so scared of that book? He's like, it's a dangerous book. He even writes it on the back. And even when I said, oh, I'll buy that one, he said to me, yeah, be careful, though. It's a very dangerous book.
I don't know. I mean, I thought it just presented a pretty straightforward defense of slavery, which it doesn't even do for most of the book. I mean, most of the book is really just about sensible economics and social relations for the South, circa 1850. I didn't find it particularly spicy, actually. I found it, I don't know, fairly straightforward. I mean, it addresses issues like feminism as well in 1850, and the relationship between, you know, the family and religion. I mean, it covers sort of the whole spectrum of culture. And so, yeah, it was extremely relevant. I would recommend reading it. And I think if Skeptical Waves wanted to do it, it's certainly not too spicy, really.
I mean, cool. It's critical of laissez-faire, but I mean, even the defense of slavery felt very Aristotelian.
Yeah, I was about to say that.
Yeah, it's not as, I've read it too, it's not as nearly as spicy, I think, as, say, the occasional discourses. But I would recommend that Waves narrates it as well.
Cool. Well, next up, I've got a short season of Sex and Women. There's a couple of books, based books from history about sex and women. Maybe Dee will find those interesting.
Like Otto Weininger? Or?
Yeah, Weininger and Sexual Power in Utopia. There's a couple others.
Sexual Personae by Camille Paglia.
Oh, that reminds me, I need to reorder my copy of Steel Storm and
I tell you that there's one book that I've never been able to find that would be good to have as an audio, which is it J.D. Unwin, Sex and Culture?
I've never Yes, exactly. That yeah, that's actually one of the ones on the list.
Oh, very interesting.
Yeah. So there's I'm gonna cover a bunch of those because I've noticed those popping up in a couple of adjacent spheres to ours, and I didn't really get anything out for the women question discussions that were a while ago, and I think I want to cover these.
Blairo393 says, Alan McLeod, Lib Sock, tweeted an article yesterday linking Tucker Carlson to the CIA via his dad and visiting Nicaraguan Contras in the 1980s. Thoughts? Might explain why he's never taken off air. I haven't seen it, so I wouldn't want to speculate. White Raven says, there is an image of a Pepe frog retaking the blue pill as a monster shows up on the path ahead and his friend running to stop him sounds familiar. So there we go. All right. I didn't want this to be too long of a stream. So Foundations of Politics is out. Buy it now. Buy it now. Get the mega bundle. Get the super bundle. Use your coupon codes if you're channel members. Anything you would like to shill, Charlemagne?
Yeah, I need to finalize the schedule, but thinking about doing a first time ever stream on my channel with hopefully the Prudentialist, Turnip, and Closington, if they can all show up on Friday. And I want to discuss what happened at the event in terms of narrative changes, ideological shifts, maybe new ideas, sort of like try and help the audience who wasn't there understand like the decisions that were made basically by not just the speakers, but you know, the 100 people at the event more or less constituted a sort of congress of reactionaries and what, and of reactionaries, you know, and a lot of the streams summarizing the event have been on sort of summaries of the talks in a way, but I kind of want to try and address the like decisions that were made or at least proposed for the viewers. So hopefully I will have that on Friday. Assuming I still have to talk to Closington. So look out for that then.
Brood.
Tomorrow I will have a Substack out. It's going to be a 2-part series on sort of the Ukraine and the larger picture, geopolitically speaking. The second part will hopefully be out later on Praxarchy. So we're going to start promoting them more often. This Friday, I have a video out on the genre of analog horror. It'll be a fun time talking about that. And then this Sunday, I know for sure I have Praise of Folly on, Todd Lewis coming on to talk about Ukraine on my regular Sunday show. But if you wanted to catch up on some news that wasn't about Ukraine, you can go check out my conversation with Ernst von Ziel of AfriForum talking about the Julius Malema trial and why that's it matters to white people outside of South Africa. So I've got plenty of stuff for you to tune in on.
And you're coming on UO tomorrow night.
Oh, yes, of course. And I'll be on Unpopular Opinions.
D.
Let's see. What do I want to show? I just default to my position of shilling all these fine fellows. You know, Charlemagne had the excellent Substack article, which if you follow me, I retweeted it. And certainly, a Prudentialist is always worth a listen, and everyone should, of course, subscribe to Skeptical Waves. But most importantly, you should buy now your copy of The Foundations of Politics. And while you're there, why don't you just buy all the other courses as well? I mean, you can
The mega bundle.
You can just buy them. Buy all of them. Buy all of them. You know, just buy them now. I order you. I command you.
Skeptical Waves.
Well, right now I'm chasing geopolitics material. So if Putin has said something interesting in an essay or a speech form, then I'm trying to get that into a more consumable version and putting some stuff out there. And I might have to poke Prudentialist about some other good material.
Mr. As well as... Waves, I have a whole stream for a top 10 books on geopolitics that you should be reading.
And some Mearsheimer. I notice he's got a lot of interesting articles, so I've been mining that. And other than that, I am going through the entire back catalog of Unqualified Reservations from Mr. Molebug. And so eventually every single item will be up, in addition to all of the other long stuff I already did from him. And that's going up slowly, continuously, to fill in the gaps while I work on those books that I mentioned. And buy, you know, Foundations of Politics, of course.
Yeah, of course. Buy Foundations of Politics. Buy it now. Maybe I'll do another, like, Foundations of Econ-style trailer for it. You know, another Steve Turley-style one. We'll see. I don't know where I found that music. I think it's an MC Hammer track on that Foundations of Econ advert, I think. But just before I go, one of the... I don't know if it's a geopolitics book, but I want to read that fourth generation warfare book that they always go on about. Is that one that you'd recommend, Prude? Or is that not on the list?
No, it's required reading.
Yeah, the fourth. What's it called? Fourth Generation Industrial Warfare.
It's by the
William Lind, I think it's called, is the author.
I believe it's Fourth Generation Warfare by William S. Lind. But it's also with Gregory Thiel as well. I've got another one
like that, which is by a Chinese dude.
Yeah, Unrestricted Warfare. That came out in the 90s. That one I would recommend over Fourth Generation Warfare, because that came out about 30 years ago, and it is still pretty much relevant to this day.
Fantastic. Yeah, I think we've done Super Chats, unless I missed anything. Munch My Wolf says, I sent your Deconstructing Boomer Truth video to an older relative. He replied, I thought it was a bit simplistic and not helpful at this point in time. Any thoughts? People's egos getting in the way. I would suggest that the Deconstructing Boomer Truth stuff is basically, like, if it comes up against somebody like Ruba or like anybody of that kind of mindset, they'll be impenetrable. So I wouldn't even bother persisting with it.
And who would really want to penetrate Ruba anyway?
Exactly. You know. So I mean, I do. I am of the opinion that many people just need to be written off, even if they're like, you know, your own dad or relatives of yours or whatever. Some people will be too far gone, and just basically unrecoverable, especially at this point in time. Yiz says, I'm late because you sniped me. Glad your new course is out. Love to all the panelists for their great work. And love to you as well, Yiz. I thought Dave, the distributist, was extremely nice about Yiz and said she was the life and soul of the event. Is that true? That she's got like a childlike exuberance and wonder for the world.
She was the most encouraging and friendly, and she was kind of like an old school revivalist in a church where people would say praise God in between the sermons, but she would just say based or something in between the speeches and the pauses. It was really wonderful.
Okay. All right. I think that's everything.
Yes. Oh, I saw Zurius in chat there. I added him to the Find My Friends site.
Oh yeah, Zurius is back. He's re-uploading all his old hits on Odyssey. I'm a big fan. I know people find him a bit cringe, but I'm a big fan of Zurius featuring Mark Brahman, the Stranger. I love that. I've always thought it's really cool. Mark Brahman's voice in that song is nothing like his actual voice. I don't know where that accent comes from, but it's there's something very based about that particular record by Zurius. So.
I join you, AA. I hope Zurius does a. Did you not ask him to do a version of the Mr. Men theme? That would be absolutely.
Oh yeah, amazing. I mean, if Zurius can do based dark synthwave Mr. Men, I would love him forever. All right,
yeah.
That'll do, everybody. Thoughts on the Spanish War II, Snowmageddon. I don't know what that's in reference to. Is it snowing in Spain? What's that a reference to? I don't know. That was from QWERTY Z7.
All right, I'm going to go before.
Well, the Canadian dollars make me think the truckers.
Why is it Spanish Civil War II? Eh? We'll be back tomorrow night for UO. I may do a shorter launch vid as well. We'll see. But for now, buy the course. I'm gonna go and put my feet up and watch some internet racists talk about Ukraine for the 18th hour today. So, all right, bye everyone. Get out.
Bye.
Out.
Bye.